I would provide behind-the-scenes input on the substance of the foreign policy speech, and that CNI officials would coordinate the logistics of the speech with Sessions and his staff, including Sessions' chief of staff, Rick Dearborn, footnote 612. In mid-April 2016, Kushner put Symes in contact with senior policy advisor Stephen Miller and forwarded to Symes an outline of the foreign policy speech that Miller had prepared, footnote 613. Symes sent back to the campaign bullet points with ideas for the speech that he had drafted with CNI Executive Director Paul Saunders and board member Richard Burt, footnote 614. Symes received subsequent draft outlines from Miller, and he and Saunders spoke to Miller by phone about substantive changes to the speech, footnote 615. It is not clear, however, whether CNI officials received an actual draft of the speech for comment. While Saunders recalled having received an actual draft, Symes did not, and the emails that CNI produced to this office do not contain such a draft. Footnote 616. After board members expressed concern to Symes that CNI's hosting the speech could be perceived as an endorsement of a particular candidate, CNI decided to have its publication, The National Interest, serve as the host and to have the event at the National Press Club. Footnote 617. Kushner later requested that the event be moved to the Mayflower Hotel, which was another venue that Symes had mentioned during initial discussions with the campaign in order to address concerns about security and capacity. Footnote 618. On April 25, 2016, Saunders booked event rooms at the Mayflower to host both the speech and a VIP reception that was to be held beforehand. Footnote 619. Saunders understood that the reception, at which invitees would have the chance to meet candidate Trump, would be a small event. Footnote 620. Saunders decided who would attend by looking at the list of CNI's invitees to the speech itself and then choosing a subset for the reception. Footnote 621. CNI's invitees to the reception included Sessions and Kislyak. Footnote 622. The week before the speech, Symes had informed Kislyak that he would be invited to the speech and that he would have the opportunity to meet Trump. Footnote 623. When the pre-speech reception began on April 27th, a receiving line was quickly organized so that attendees could meet Trump. Footnote 624. Sessions first stood next to Trump to introduce him to the members of Congress who were in attendance. Footnote 625. After those members had been introduced, Symes stood next to Trump and introduced him to the CNI invitees in attendance, including Kislyak. Footnote 626. Symes perceived the introduction to be positive and friendly, but thought it clear that Kislyak and Trump had just met for the first time. Footnote 627. Kislyak also met Kushner during the pre-speech reception. The two shook hands and chatted for a minute or two, during which Kushner recalled Kislyak saying, "We like what your candidate is saying. It's refreshing." Footnote 628. Several public reports state that in addition to speaking to Kushner at the pre-speech reception, Kislyak also met or conversed with Sessions at that time. Footnote 629. Sessions stated to investigators, however, that he did not remember any such conversation. Footnote 630. Nor did anyone else affiliated with CNI or the National Interest specifically recall a conversation or meeting between Sessions and Kislyak at the pre-speech reception. Footnote 631. It appears that if a conversation occurred at the pre-speech reception, it was a brief one conducted in public view, similar to the exchange between Kushner and Kislyak. The office found no evidence that Kislyak conversed with either Trump or Sessions after the speech, or would have had the opportunity to do so. Symes, for example, did not recall seeing Kislyak at the post-speech luncheon, footnote 632. And the only witness who accounted for Sessions' whereabouts stated that Sessions may have spoken to the press after the event, but then departed for Capitol Hill, footnote 633. Saunders recalled, based in part on a food-related request he received from a campaign staff member, that Trump left the hotel a few minutes after the speech to go to the airport. Footnote 634. C. Jeff Sessions' post-speech interactions with CNI. In the wake of Sessions' confirmation hearings as Attorney General, questions arose about whether Sessions' campaign period interactions with CNI, apart from the Mayflower speech, included any additional meetings with Ambassador Kislyak or involved Russian-related matters. With respect to Kislyak contacts, on May 23, 2016, Sessions attended CNI's Distinguished Service Award dinner at the Four Seasons Hotel in Washington, D.C. Footnote 635. Sessions attended a pre-dinner reception and was seated at one of two head tables for the event. Footnote 636. A seating chart prepared by Saunders indicates that Sessions was scheduled to be seated next to Kislyak, who appears to have responded to the invitation by indicating he would attend the event. Footnote 637. Sessions, however, did not remember seeing, speaking with, or sitting next to Kislyak at the dinner. Footnote 638. Although CNI board member Charles Boyd said that he may have seen Kislyak at the dinner, footnote 639, Symes, Saunders, and Jacob Halbrun, editor of the National Interest, all had no recollection of seeing Kislyak at the May 23rd event. Footnote 640. Kislyak also does not appear in any of the photos from the event that the office obtained. In the summer of 2016, CNI organized at least two dinners in Washington, D.C. for Sessions to meet with experienced foreign policy professionals. Footnote 641. The dinners included CNI-affiliated individuals such as Richard Burt and Zalmay Khalilzad, a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and Iraq, and the person who had introduced Trump before the April 27, 2016 foreign policy speech. Footnote 642. Khalilzad also met with Sessions one-on-one separately from the dinners. Footnote 643. At the dinners and in the meetings, the participants addressed U.S. relations with Russia, including how U.S. relations with NATO and European countries affected U.S. policy toward Russia. Footnote 644. But the discussions were not exclusively focused on Russia. Footnote 645. Khalilzad, for example, recalled discussing nation-building and violent extremism with Sessions. Footnote 646. In addition, Sessions asked Saunders of CNI to draft two memoranda not specific to Russia, one on Hillary Clinton's foreign policy shortcomings and another on Egypt. Footnote 647. D. Jared Kushner's continuing contacts with Symes. Between the April 2016 speech at the Mayflower Hotel and the presidential election, Jared Kushner had periodic contacts with Symes. Footnote 648. Those contacts consisted of both in-person meetings and phone conversations, which concerned how to address issues relating to Russia in the campaign and how to move forward with the advisory group of foreign policy experts that Symes had proposed. Footnote 649. Symes recalled that he, not Kushner, initiated all conversations about Russia, and that Kushner never asked him to set up back-channel conversations with Russians. Footnote 650. According to Symes, after the Mayflower speech in late April, Symes raised the issue of Russian contacts with Kushner, advised that it was bad optics for the campaign to develop hidden Russian contacts, and told Kushner both that the campaign should not highlight Russia as an issue and should handle any contacts with Russians with care. Footnote 651. Kushner generally provided a similar account of his interactions with Symes. Footnote 652. Among the Kushner-Symes meetings was one held on August 17, 2016, at Symes's request, in Kushner's New York office. The meeting was to address foreign policy advice that CNI was providing and how to respond to the Clinton campaign's Russia-related attacks on candidate Trump. Footnote 653. In advance of the meeting, Symes sent Kushner a Russia policy memo laying out what Mr. Trump may want to say about Russia, footnote 654. In a cover email transmitting that memo and a phone call to set up the meeting, Symes mentioned a well-documented story of highly questionable connections between Bill Clinton and the Russian government, parts of which, according to Symes, had even been discussed with the CIA and the FBI in the late 1990s and shared with the Independent Counsel at the end of the Clinton presidency. Footnote 655. Kushner forwarded the email to senior Trump campaign officials Stephen Miller, Paul Manafort, and Rick Gates, with the note, "Suggestion only," footnote 656. Manafort subsequently forwarded the email to his assistant and scheduled a meeting with Symes, footnote 657. Manafort was on the verge of leaving the campaign by the time of the scheduled meeting with Symes, and Symes ended up meeting only with Kushner. During the August 17th meeting, Symes provided Kushner the Clinton-related information that he had promised, footnote 658. Symes told Kushner that, redaction, personal privacy, including footnote 659. Symes claimed that he had received this information from former CIA and Reagan White House official Fritz Ehrmarth, who claimed to have learned it from U.S. intelligence sources, not from Russians. Footnote 660. Symes perceived that Kushner did not find the information to be of interest or use to the campaign because it was, in Symes's words, old news. Footnote 661. When interviewed by the office, Kushner stated that he believed that there was little chance of something new being revealed about the Clintons, given their long career as public figures, and that he never received from Symes information that could be operationalized for the Trump campaign. Footnote 662. Despite Kushner's reaction, Symes believed that he provided the same information at a small group meeting of foreign policy experts that CNI organized for Sessions. Footnote 663.
5. June 9, 2016 meeting at Trump Tower. On June 9, 2016, senior representatives of the Trump campaign met in Trump Tower with a Russian attorney expecting to receive derogatory information about Hillary Clinton from the Russian government. The meeting was proposed to Donald Trump Jr. in an email from Robert Goldstone at the request of his then-client Emin Agalarov, the son of Russian real estate developer Aras Agalarov. Goldstone relayed to Trump Jr. that the, quote, Crown Prosecutor of Russia offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia, unquote, as, quote, part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump, unquote. Trump Jr. immediately responded that, if it's what you say, I love it, and arranged the meeting through a series of emails and telephone calls. Trump Jr. invited campaign chairman Paul Manafort and senior advisor Jared Kushner to attend the meeting, and both attended. Members of the campaign discussed the meeting before it occurred, and Michael Cohen recalled that Trump Jr. may have told candidate Trump about an upcoming meeting to receive adverse information about Clinton, without linking the meeting to Russia. According to written answers submitted by President Trump, he has no recollection of learning of the meeting at the time, and the office found no documentary evidence showing that he was made aware of the meeting, or its Russian connection, before it occurred. The Russian attorney who spoke at the meeting, Natalia Veselinitskaya, had previously worked for the Russian government and maintained a relationship with that government throughout this period of time. She claimed that funds derived from illegal activities in Russia were provided to Hillary Clinton and other Democrats. Trump Jr. requested evidence to support those claims, but Veselinitskaya did not provide such information. She and her associates then turned to a critique of the origins of the Magnitsky Act, a 2012 statute that imposed financial and travel sanctions on Russian officials and that resulted in a retaliatory ban on adoptions of Russian children. Trump Jr. suggested that the issue could be revisited when and if candidate Trump was elected. After the election, Veselinitskaya made additional efforts to follow up on the meeting, but the Trump transition team did not engage. A. Setting up the June 9th meeting. 1. Outreach to Donald Trump Jr. Aras Agalarov is a Russian real estate developer with ties to Putin and other members of the Russian government, including Russia's Prosecutor General, Yuri Chaika. Footnote 664. Aras Agalarov is the president of the Crocus Group, a Russian enterprise that holds substantial Russian government construction contracts and that, as discussed above, Volume 1, Section 4.A.1 Supra, worked with Trump in connection with the 2013 Miss Universe pageant in Moscow and a potential Trump-Moscow real estate project. Footnote 665. The relationship continued over time, as the parties pursued the Trump-Moscow project in 2013 to 2014 and exchanged gifts and letters in 2016. Footnote 666. For example, in April 2016, Trump responded to a letter from Aras Agalarov with a handwritten note. Footnote 667. Aras Agalarov expressed interest in Trump's campaign, passed on congratulations for winning in the primary, and, according to one email drafted by Goldstone, an offer of his, quote, support and that of many of his important Russian friends and colleagues, especially with reference to U.S.-Russian relations, unquote. Footnote 668. On June 3, 2016, Emin Agalarov called Goldstone, Emin's then-publicist. Footnote 669. Goldstone is a music and events promoter who represented Emin Agalarov from approximately late 2012 until late 2016. Footnote 670. While representing Emin Agalarov, Goldstone facilitated the ongoing contact between the Trumps and the Agalarovs, including an invitation that Trump sent to Putin to attend the 2013 Miss Universe pageant in Moscow. Footnote 671. Redaction, Grand Jury, including footnote 672. Goldstone understood, redaction, Grand Jury, a Russian political connection, and Emin Agalarov indicated that the attorney was a prosecutor. Footnote 673. Goldstone recalled that the information that might interest the Trumps involved Hillary Clinton. Redaction, Grand Jury. Footnote 674. Redaction, Grand Jury, including footnote 675. The redaction, Grand Jury, mentioned by Emin Agalarov was Natalia Veselinitskaya. Footnote 676. From approximately 1998 until 2001, Veselinitskaya worked as a prosecutor for the Central Administrative District of the Russian Prosecutor's Office. Footnote 677. And she continued to perform government-related work and maintain ties to the Russian government following her departure. Footnote 678. She lobbied and testified about the Magnitsky Act, which imposed financial sanctions and travel restrictions on Russian officials and which was named for a Russian tax specialist who exposed a fraud and later died in a Russian prison. Footnote 679. Putin called the statute, quote, a purely political, unfriendly act, unquote, and Russia responded by barring a list of current and former U.S. officials from entering Russia and by halting the adoption of Russian children by U.S. citizens. Footnote 680. Veselinitskaya performed legal work for Denis Katsev, footnote 681, the son of Russian businessman Peter Katsev, and for his company Prevazon Holdings Limited, which was a defendant in a civil forfeiture action alleging the laundering of proceeds from the fraud exposed by Magnitsky, footnote 682. She also appears to have been involved in an April 2016 approach to a U.S. congressional delegation in Moscow offering, quote, confidential information, unquote, from, quote, the Prosecutor General of Russia, unquote, about, quote, interactions between certain political forces in our two countries, unquote. Footnote 683. Shortly after his June 3rd call with Emin Agalarov, Goldstone emailed Trump Jr., footnote 684. The email stated, "Good morning. Emin just called and asked me to contact you with something very interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aras, this morning, and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aras and Emin. What do you think is the best way to handle this information, and would you be able to speak to Emin about it directly? I can also send this info to your father via Rona, but it's ultra-sensitive, so wanted to send to you first. Best, Rob Goldstone." Within minutes of this email, Trump Jr. responded, emailing back, quote, "Thanks, Rob. I appreciate that. I'm on the road at the moment, but perhaps I just speak to Emin first. Seems we have some time, and if it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer. Could we do a call first thing next week when I am back?" Unquote. Footnote 685. Goldstone conveyed Trump Jr.'s interest to Emin Agalarov, emailing that Trump Jr., quote, "wants to speak personally on the issue," unquote. Footnote 686. On June 6, 2016, Emin Agalarov asked Goldstone if there was, quote, "any news," unquote, and Goldstone explained that Trump Jr. was likely still traveling for the, quote, "final elections, where Trump will be crowned the official nominee," unquote. Footnote 687. On the same day, Goldstone again emailed Trump Jr. and asked when Trump Jr. was, quote, "free to talk with Emin about this Hillary info," unquote. Footnote 688. Trump Jr. asked if they could, quote, "speak now," unquote, and Goldstone arranged a call between Trump Jr. and Emin Agalarov. Footnote 689. On June 6th and June 7th, Trump Jr. and Emin Agalarov had multiple brief calls. Footnote 690. Also on June 6, 2016, Aras Agalarov called Ike Kabaladze and asked him to attend a meeting in New York with the Trump Organization. Footnote 691. Kabaladze is a Georgia-born naturalized U.S. citizen who worked in the United States for the Crocus Group and reported to Aras Agalarov. Footnote 692. Kabaladze told the office that, in a second phone call on June 6, 2016, Aras Agalarov asked Kabaladze if he knew anything about the Magnitsky Act, and Aras sent him a short synopsis for the meeting and Veselenitskaya's business card. According to Kabaladze, Aras Agalarov said the purpose of the meeting was to discuss the Magnitsky Act, and he asked Kabaladze to translate. Footnote 693. 2. Awareness of the meeting within the campaign. On June 7th, Goldstone emailed Trump Jr. and said that, quote, "Emin asked that I schedule a meeting with you and the Russian government attorney who is flying over from Moscow," unquote. Footnote 694. Trump Jr. replied that Manafort, identified as the campaign boss, Jared Kushner, and Trump Jr. would likely attend. Footnote 695. Goldstone was surprised to learn that Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner would attend. Footnote 696. Kabaladze, redaction, grand jury, quote, "puzzled," unquote, by the list of attendees, and that he checked with one of Emin Agalarov's assistants, Roman Benyaminov, who said that the purpose of the meeting was for Veselenitskaya to convey, quote, "negative information on Hillary Clinton," unquote. Footnote 697. Benyaminov, however, stated that he did not recall having known or said that. Footnote 698. Early on June 8, 2016, Kushner emailed his assistant, asking her to discuss a 3 p.m. meeting the following day with Trump Jr. Footnote 699. Later that day, Trump Jr. forwarded the entirety of his email correspondence regarding the meeting with Goldstone to Manafort and Kushner, under the subject line, quote, FW:Russia, Clinton, private and confidential, unquote, adding a note that the, quote, meeting got moved to 4 tomorrow at my offices, unquote. Footnote 700. Kushner then sent his assistant a second email informing her that the, quote, meeting with Don Jr. is 4 p.m. now, unquote. Footnote 701. Manafort responded, quote, see you then, P, unquote. Footnote 702. Rick Gates, who was the deputy campaign chairman, stated during interviews with the office that in the days before June 9, 2016, Trump Jr. announced at a regular morning meeting of senior campaign staff and Trump family members that he had a lead on negative information about the Clinton Foundation. Footnote 703. Gates believed that Trump Jr. said the information was coming from a group in Kyrgyzstan and that he was introduced to the group by a friend. Footnote 704. Gates recalled that the meeting was attended by Trump Jr., Eric Trump, Paul Manafort, Hope Hicks, and, joining late, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. According to Gates, Manafort warned the group that the meeting likely would not yield vital information and they should be careful. Footnote 705. Hicks denied any knowledge of the June 9th meeting before 2017. Footnote 706. And Kushner did not recall if the planned June 9th meeting came up at all earlier that week. Footnote 707. Michael Cohen recalled being in Donald J. Trump's office on June 6th or 7th when Trump Jr. told his father that a meeting to obtain adverse information about Clinton was going forward. Footnote 708. Cohen did not recall Trump Jr. stating that the meeting was connected to Russia. Footnote 709. From the tenor of the conversation, Cohen believed that Trump Jr. had previously discussed the meeting with his father, although Cohen was not involved in any such conversation. Footnote 710. In an interview with the Senate Judiciary Committee, however, Trump Jr. stated that he did not inform his father about the emails or the upcoming meeting. Footnote 711. Similarly, neither Manafort nor Kushner recalled anyone informing candidate Trump of the meeting, including Trump Jr. Footnote 712. President Trump has stated to this office, in written answers to questions, that he has, quote, no recollection of learning at the time, unquote, that his son, Manafort, or, quote, Kushner, was considering participating in a meeting in June 2016 concerning potentially negative information about Hillary Clinton, unquote. Footnote 713. B. The events of June 9, 2016. 1. Arrangements for the meeting. Veselenitskaya was in New York on June 9, 2016 for appellate proceedings in the Prevazan civil forfeiture litigation. Footnote 714. That day, Veselenitskaya called Rinat Akhmetshin, a Soviet-born U.S. lobbyist, redaction, grand jury, and when she learned that he was in New York, invited him to lunch. Footnote 715. Akhmetshin told the office that he had worked on issues relating to the Magnitsky Act and had worked on the Prevazan litigation. Footnote 716. Kavaladze and Anatoly Samokornov, a Russian-born translator who had assisted Veselenitskaya with Magnitsky-related lobbying and the Prevazan case, also attended the lunch. Footnote 717. Redaction, grand jury. Veselenitskaya said she was meeting, redaction, grand jury, and asked Akhmetshin what she should tell him. Footnote 718. According to several participants in the lunch, Veselenitskaya showed Akhmetshin a document alleging financial misconduct by Bill Browder and the Ziff brothers, Americans with business in Russia, and those individuals subsequently making political donations to the DNC. Footnote 719. Redaction, grand jury, including footnote 720. The group then went to Trump Tower for the meeting. Footnote 721. 2. Conduct of the meeting. Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner participated on the Trump side, while Kavaladze, Samokornov, Akhmetshin, and Goldstone attended with Veselenitskaya. Footnote 722. The office spoke to every participant except Veselenitskaya and Trump Jr., the latter of whom declined to be voluntarily interviewed by the office. Redaction, Grand Jury. The meeting lasted approximately 20 minutes. Footnote 723. Redaction, Grand Jury, including footnote 724. Goldstone recalled that Trump Jr. invited Veselenitskaya to begin but did not say anything about the subject of the meeting. Footnote 725. Participants agreed that Veselenitskaya stated that the Ziff brothers had broken Russian laws and had donated their profits to the DNC or the Clinton campaign. Footnote 726. She asserted that the Ziff brothers had engaged in tax evasion and money laundering in both the United States and Russia. Footnote 727. Redaction, Grand Jury, including footnote 728. According to Akhmetshin, Trump Jr. asked follow-up questions about how the alleged payments could be tied specifically to the Clinton campaign, but Veselenitskaya indicated that she could not trace the money once it entered the United States. Footnote 729. Kavaladze similarly recalled that Trump Jr. asked what they have on Clinton, and Kushner became aggravated and asked, quote, "What are we doing here?" Unquote. Footnote 730. Akhmetshin then spoke about U.S. sanctions imposed under the Magnitsky Act and Russia's response prohibiting U.S. adoption of Russian children. Footnote 731. Several participants recalled that Trump Jr. commented that Trump is a private citizen and there was nothing they could do at that time. Footnote 732. Trump Jr. also said they could revisit the issue if and when they were in government. Footnote 733. Notes that Manafort took on his phone reflect the general flow of the conversation, although not all of its details. Footnote 734. At some point in the meeting, Kushner sent an iMessage to Manafort stating, quote, "waste of time," unquote, followed immediately by two separate emails to assistants at Kushner companies with requests that they call him to give him an excuse to leave. Footnote 735. Samokornov recalled that Kushner departed the meeting before it concluded. Veselenitskaya recalled the same when interviewed by the press in July 2017. Footnote 736. Veselenitskaya's press interviews and written statements to Congress differ materially from other accounts. In a July 2017 press interview, Veselenitskaya claimed that she has no connection to the Russian government and had not referred to any derogatory information concerning the Clinton campaign when she met with Trump campaign officials. Footnote 737. Veselenitskaya's November 2017 written submission to the Senate Judiciary Committee stated that the purpose of the June 9th meeting was not to connect with, quote, the Trump campaign, unquote, but rather to have, quote, a private meeting with Donald Trump Jr., a friend of my good acquaintance's son, on the matter of assisting me or my colleagues in informing the Congress members as to the criminal nature of manipulation and interference with the legislative activities of the U.S. Congress, unquote. Footnote 738. In other words, Veselenitskaya claimed her focus was on Congress and not the campaign. No witness, however, recalled any reference to Congress during the meeting. Veselenitskaya also maintained that she, quote, attended the meeting as a lawyer of Denis Katsev, unquote, the previously mentioned owner of Prevazon Holdings, but she did not, quote, introduce herself in this capacity, unquote. Footnote 739. In a July 2017 television interview, Trump Jr. stated that while he had no way to gauge the reliability, credibility, or accuracy of what Goldstone had stated was the purpose of the meeting, if, quote, someone has information on our opponent, maybe this is something. I should hear them out, unquote. Footnote 740. Trump Jr. further stated in September 2017 congressional testimony that he thought he should, quote, listen to what Rob and his colleagues had to say, unquote. Footnote 741. Depending on what, if any, information was provided, Trump Jr. stated he could then, quote, consult with counsel to make an informed decision as to whether to give it any further consideration, unquote. Footnote 742. After the June 9th meeting concluded, Goldstone apologized to Trump Jr. Footnote 743. According to Goldstone, he told Trump Jr., redaction, grand jury, including footnote 744, and told Emin Agalarov in a phone call that the meeting was about adoption, redaction, grand jury, including footnotes 745 and 746. Aras Agalarov asked Kavaladze to report in after the meeting, but before Kavaladze could call, Aras Agalarov called him, footnote 747. With Veselenitskaya next to him, Kavaladze reported that the meeting had gone well, but he later told Aras Agalarov that the meeting about the Magnitsky Act had been a waste of time because it was not with lawyers and they were, quote, preaching to the wrong crowd, unquote. Footnote 748. C. Post-June 9th events. Veselenitskaya and Aras Agalarov made at least two unsuccessful attempts after the election to meet with Trump representatives to convey similar information about Browder and the Magnitsky Act. Footnote 749. On November 23, 2016, Kavaladze emailed Goldstone about setting up another meeting, quote, with tea people, unquote, and sent a document bearing allegations similar to those conveyed on June 9th. Footnote 750. Kavaladze followed up with Goldstone, stating that Mr. A, which Goldstone understood to mean Aras Agalarov, called to ask about the meeting. Footnote 751. Goldstone emailed the document to Rona Graf, saying that, quote, Aras Agalarov has asked me to pass on this document in the hopes it can be passed on to the appropriate team. If needed, a lawyer representing the case is in New York currently and happy to meet with any member of his transition team, unquote. Footnote 752. According to Goldstone, around January 2017, Kavaladze contacted him again to set up another meeting, but Goldstone did not make the request. Footnote 753. The investigation did not identify evidence of the transition team following up. Participants in the June 9, 2016 meeting began receiving inquiries from attorneys representing the Trump Organization starting in approximately June 2017. Footnote 754. On approximately June 2, 2017, Goldstone spoke with Alan Garten, general counsel of the Trump Organization, about his participation in the June 9 meeting. Footnote 755. The same day, Goldstone emailed Veselenitskaya's name to Garten, identifying her as the, quote, woman who was the attorney who spoke at the meeting from Moscow, unquote. Footnote 756. Later in June 2017, Goldstone participated in a lengthier call with Garten and Alan Feuerfass, outside counsel for the Trump Organization, and subsequently personal counsel for Trump Jr. Footnote 757. On June 27, 2017, Goldstone emailed Emin Agalarov with the subject, quote, Trump attorneys, unquote, and stated that he was, quote, interviewed by attorneys, unquote, about the June 9th meeting who were, quote, concerned because it links Don Jr. to officials from Russia, which he has always denied meeting, unquote. Footnote 758. Goldstone stressed that he, quote, did say at the time this was an awful idea and a terrible meeting, unquote. Footnote 759. Emin Agalarov sent a screenshot of the message to Kavaladze. Footnote 760. The June 9th meeting became public in July 2017. In a July 9th, 2017 text message to Emin Agalarov, Goldstone wrote, I made sure I kept you and your father out of this story. Footnote 761. And, if contacted, I can do a dance and keep you out of it. Footnote 762. Goldstone added, FBI now investigating. And, I hope this favor was worth for your dad. It could blow up. Footnote 763. On July 12, 2017, Emin Agalarov complained to Kavaladze that his father, Aris, quote, never listens, unquote, to him, and that their relationship with, quote, Mr. T has been thrown down the drain, unquote. Footnote 764. The next month, Goldstone commented to Emin Agalarov about the volume of publicity the June 9th meeting had generated, stating that his, quote, reputation was basically destroyed by this dumb meeting which your father insisted on, even though Ike and me told him would be bad news and not to do, unquote. Footnote 765. Goldstone added, quote, I am not able to respond out of courtesy to you and your father, so am painted as some mysterious link to Putin, unquote. Footnote 766. After public reporting on the June 9th meeting began, representatives from the Trump Organization again reached out to participants. On July 10, 2017, Feuderfass sent Goldstone an email with a proposed statement for Goldstone to issue, which read, As the person who arranged the meeting, I can definitively state that the statements I have read by Donald Trump Jr. are 100% accurate. The meeting was a complete waste of time, and Don was never told Ms. Veselinitskaya's name prior to the meeting. Ms. Veselinitskaya mostly talked about the Magnitsky Act and Russian adoption laws, and the meeting lasted 20 to 30 minutes at most. There was never any follow-up, and nothing ever came of the meeting. Footnote 767. Redaction, Grand Jury. The statement drafted by Trump Organization representatives was Redaction, Grand Jury, including footnote 768. He proposed a different statement, asserting that he had been asked, quote, by his client in Moscow, Emin Agalarov, to facilitate a meeting between a Russian attorney, Natalia Veselinitskaya, and Donald Trump Jr. The lawyer had apparently stated that she had some information regarding funding to the DNC from Russia, which she believed Mr. Trump Jr. might find interesting, unquote. Footnote 769. Goldstone never released either statement. Footnote 770. On the Russian end, there were also communications about what participants should say about the June 9th meeting. Specifically, the organization that hired Semikhornov, an anti-Magnitsky Act group controlled by Veselinitskaya and the owner of Prevezon, offered to pay $90,000 of Semikhornov's legal fees. Footnote 771. At Veselinitskaya's request, the organization sent Semikhornov a transcript of a Veselinitskaya press interview, and Semikhornov understood that the organization would pay his legal fees only if he made statements consistent with Veselinitskaya's. Footnote 772. Semikhornov declined, telling the office that he did not want to perjure himself. Footnote 773. The individual who conveyed Veselinitskaya's request to Semikhornov stated that he did not expressly condition payment on following Veselinitskaya's answers, but, in hindsight, recognized that by sending the transcript, Semikhornov could have interpreted the offer of assistance to be conditioned on his not contradicting Veselinitskaya's account. Footnote 774. Volume 2, Section 2.G, Infra, discusses interactions between President Trump, Trump Jr., and others in June and July 2017 regarding the June 9th meeting. 6. Events at the Republican National Convention. Trump campaign officials met with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the week of the Republican National Convention. The evidence indicates that those interactions were brief and non-substantive. During platform committee meetings immediately before the convention, J.D. Gordon, a senior campaign advisor on policy and national security, diluted a proposed amendment to the Republican Party platform expressing support for providing, quote, lethal, unquote, assistance to Ukraine in response to Russian aggression. Gordon requested that platform committee personnel revise the proposed amendment to state that only, quote, appropriate, unquote, assistance be provided to Ukraine. The original sponsor of the lethal assistance amendment stated that Gordon told her, the sponsor, that he was on the phone with candidate Trump in connection with his request to dilute the language. Gordon denied making that statement to the sponsor, although he acknowledged it was possible he mentioned having previously spoken to the candidate about the subject matter. The investigation did not establish that Gordon spoke to or was directed by the candidate to make that proposal. Gordon said that he sought the change because he believed the proposed language was inconsistent with Trump's position on Ukraine. A. Ambassador Kislyak's encounters with Senator Sessions and J.D. Gordon the week of the RNC. In July 2016, Senator Sessions and Gordon spoke at the Global Partners in Diplomacy event, a conference co-sponsored by the State Department and the Heritage Foundation held in Cleveland, Ohio, the same week as the Republican National Convention, RNC, or Convention, footnote 775. Approximately 80 foreign ambassadors to the United States, including Kislyak, were invited to the conference, footnote 776. On July 20, 2016, Gordon and Sessions delivered their speeches at the conference, footnote 777. In his speech, Gordon stated in pertinent part that the United States should have better relations with Russia, footnote 778. During Sessions' speech, he took questions from the audience, one of which may have been asked by Kislyak, footnote 779. When the speeches concluded, several ambassadors lined up to greet the speakers, footnote 780. Gordon shook hands with Kislyak and reiterated that he had meant what he said in the speech about improving U.S.-Russia relations, footnote 781. Sessions separately spoke with between 6 and 12 ambassadors, including Kislyak, footnote 782. Although Sessions stated during interviews with the office that he had no specific recollection of what he discussed with Kislyak, he believed that the two spoke for only a few minutes and that they would have exchanged pleasantries and said some things about U.S.-Russia relations, footnote 783. Later that evening, Gordon attended a reception as part of the conference, footnote 784. Gordon ran into Kislyak as the two prepared plates of food, and they decided to sit at the same table to eat, footnote 785. They were joined at that table by the ambassadors from Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, and by Trump campaign advisor Carter Page, footnote 786. As they ate, Gordon and Kislyak talked for what Gordon estimated to have been 3 to 5 minutes, during which Gordon again mentioned that he meant what he said in his speech about improving U.S.-Russia relations, footnote 787. B. Change to Republican Party Platform. In preparation for the 2016 convention, foreign policy advisors to the Trump campaign, working with the Republican National Committee, reviewed the 2012 convention's foreign policy platform to identify divergence between the earlier platform and candidate Trump's positions, footnote 788. The campaign team discussed toning down language from the 2012 platform that identified Russia as the country's number one threat, given the candidate's belief that there needed to be better U.S. relations with Russia, footnote 789. The RNC Platform Committee sent the 2016 draft platform to the National Security and Defense Platform Subcommittee on July 10, 2016, the evening before its first meeting to propose amendments, footnote 790. Although only delegates could participate in formal discussions and vote on the platform, the Trump campaign could request changes, and members of the Trump campaign attended committee meetings, footnote 791. John Mashburn, the campaign's policy director, helped oversee the campaign's involvement in the platform committee meetings, footnote 792. He told the office that he directed campaign staff at the convention, including J.D. Gordon, to take a hands-off approach and only to challenge platform planks if they directly contradicted Trump's wishes, footnote 793. On July 11, 2016, Delegate Diana Denman submitted a proposed platform amendment that included provision of armed support for Ukraine, footnote 794. The amendment described Russia's, quote, ongoing military aggression, unquote, in Ukraine, and announced support for, quote, maintaining and, if warranted, increasing sanctions against Russia until Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity are fully restored, unquote, and for, quote, providing lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine's armed forces and greater coordination with NATO on defense planning, unquote. Footnote 795. Gordon reviewed the proposed platform changes, including Denman's, footnote 796. Gordon stated that he flagged this amendment because of Trump's stated position on Ukraine, which Gordon personally heard the candidates say at the March 31st foreign policy meeting, namely, that the Europeans should take primary responsibility for any assistance to Ukraine, that there should be improved U.S.-Russia relations, and that he did not want to start World War III over that region. Footnote 797. Gordon told the office that Trump's statements on the campaign trail following the March meeting underscored those positions to the point where Gordon felt obliged to object to the proposed platform change and seek its dilution. Footnote 798. On July 11, 2016, at a meeting of the National Security and Defense Platform Subcommittee, Denman offered her amendment. Footnote 799. Gordon and another campaign staffer, Matt Miller, approached a committee co-chair and asked him to table the amendment to permit further discussion. Footnote 800. Gordon's concern with the amendment was the language about providing, quote, lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine, unquote. Footnote 801. Miller did not have any independent basis to believe that this language contradicted Trump's views and relied on Gordon's recollection of the candidate's views. Footnote 802. According to Denman, she spoke with Gordon and Matt Miller, and they told her that they had to clear the language and that Gordon was, quote, talking to New York, unquote. Footnote 803. Denman told others that she was asked by the two Trump campaign staffers to strike, quote, lethal defense weapons, unquote, from the proposal, but that she refused. Footnote 804. Denman recalled Gordon saying that he was on the phone with candidate Trump, but she was skeptical whether that was true. Footnote 805. Gordon denied having told Denman that he was on the phone with Trump, although he acknowledged it was possible that he mentioned having previously spoken to the candidate about the subject matter. Footnote 806. Gordon's phone records reveal a call to Sessions' office in Washington that afternoon, but do not include calls directly to a number associated with Trump. Footnote 807. And according to the president's written answers to the office's questions, he does not recall being involved in the change in language of the platform amendment. Footnote 808. Gordon stated that he tried to reach Rick Dearborn, a senior foreign policy advisor, and Mashburn, the campaign policy director. Gordon stated that he connected with both of them. He could not recall if by phone or in person, and apprised them of the language he took issue with in the proposed amendment. Gordon recalled no objection by either Dearborn or Mashburn, and that all three campaign advisers supported the alternative formulation, quote, appropriate assistance, unquote. Footnote 809. Dearborn recalled Gordon warning them about the amendment, but not weighing in because Gordon was more familiar with the campaign's foreign policy stance. Footnote 810. Mashburn stated that Gordon reached him and he told Gordon that Trump had not taken a stance on the issue and that the campaign should not intervene. Footnote 811. When the amendment came up again in the committee's proceedings, the subcommittee changed the amendment by striking the, quote, lethal defense weapons, unquote, language and replacing it with, quote, appropriate assistance, unquote. Footnote 812. Gordon stated that he and the subcommittee co-chair ultimately agreed to replace the language about armed assistance with, quote, appropriate assistance, unquote. Footnote 813. The subcommittee accordingly approved Denman's amendment, but with the term, quote, appropriate assistance, unquote. Footnote 814. Gordon stated that, to his recollection, this was the only change sought by the campaign. Footnote 815. Sam Clovis, the campaign's national co-chair and chief policy advisor, stated he was surprised by the change and did not believe it was in line with Trump's stance. Footnote 816. Mashburn stated that when he saw the word, quote, appropriate assistance, unquote, he believed that Gordon had violated Mashburn's directive not to intervene. Footnote 817. 7. Post-convention contacts with Kislyak. Ambassador Kislyak continued his efforts to interact with campaign officials with responsibility for the foreign policy portfolio, among them Sessions and Gordon, in the weeks after the convention. The office did not identify evidence in those interactions of coordination between the campaign and the Russian government. A. Ambassador Kislyak invites J.D. Gordon to breakfast at the ambassador's residence. On August 3, 2016, an official from the Embassy of the Russian Federation in the United States wrote to Gordon on behalf of Ambassador Kislyak, inviting Gordon, quote, to have breakfast/tea with the ambassador at his residence, unquote, in Washington, D.C. the following week. Footnote 818. Gordon responded 5 days later to decline the invitation. He wrote, quote, these days are not optimal for us, as we are busily knocking down a constant stream of false media stories while also preparing for the first debate with HRC. Hope to take a rain check for another time when things quiet down a bit. Please pass along my regards to the ambassador. Unquote. Footnote 819. The investigation did not identify evidence that Gordon made any other arrangements to meet or met with Kislyak after this email. B. Senator Sessions' September 2016 meeting with Ambassador Kislyak. Also in August 2016, a representative of the Russian embassy contacted Sessions' Senate office about setting up a meeting with Kislyak. Footnote 820. At the time, Sessions was a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and would meet with foreign officials in that capacity. Footnote 821. But Sessions' staff reported, and Sessions himself acknowledged, that meeting requests from ambassadors increased substantially in 2016. As Sessions assumed a prominent role in the Trump campaign, and his name was mentioned for potential cabinet-level positions in a future Trump administration. Footnote 822. On September 8, 2016, Sessions met with Kislyak in his Senate office. Footnote 823. Sessions said that he believed he was doing the campaign a service by meeting with foreign ambassadors, including Kislyak. Footnote 824. He was accompanied in the meeting by at least two of his Senate staff, Sandra Luff, his legislative director, and Pete Landrum, who handled military affairs. Footnote 825. The meeting lasted less than 30 minutes. Footnote 826. Sessions voiced concerns about Russia's sale of a missile defense system to Iran, Russian planes buzzing U.S. military assets in the Middle East, and Russian aggression in emerging democracies such as Ukraine and Moldova. Footnote 827. Kislyak offered explanations on these issues and complained about NATO land forces in former Soviet bloc countries that border Russia. Footnote 828. Landrum recalled that Kislyak referred to the presidential campaign as, quote, an interesting campaign, unquote. Footnote 829. And Sessions also recalled Kislyak saying that the Russian government was receptive to the overtures Trump had laid out during his campaign. Footnote 830. None of the attendees, though, remembered any discussion of Russian election interference or any request that Sessions convey information from the Russian government to the Trump campaign. Footnote 831. During the meeting, Kislyak invited Sessions to further discuss U.S.-Russia relations with him over a meal at the ambassador's residence. Footnote 832. Sessions was noncommittal when Kislyak extended the invitation. After the meeting ended, Luff advised Sessions against accepting the one-on-one meeting with Kislyak, whom she assessed to be an, quote, old-school KGB guy, unquote. Footnote 833. Neither Luff nor Landrum recalled that Sessions followed up on the invitation or made any further effort to dine or meet with Kislyak before the November 2016 election. Footnote 834. Sessions and Landrum recalled that after the election, some efforts were made to arrange a meeting between Sessions and Kislyak. Footnote 835. According to Sessions, the request came through CNI and would have involved a meeting between Sessions and Kislyak, two other ambassadors, and the governor of Alabama. Footnote 836. Sessions, however, was in New York on the day of the anticipated meeting and was unable to attend. Footnote 837. The investigation did not identify evidence that the two men met at any point after their September 8th meeting. 8. Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort served on the Trump campaign, including a period as campaign chairman, from March to August 2016. Footnote 838. Manafort had connections to Russia through his prior work for Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, and later through his work for a pro-Russian regime in Ukraine. Manafort stayed in touch with these contacts during the campaign period through Konstantin Kilimnik, a longtime Manafort employee who previously ran Manafort's office in Kiev and who the FBI assesses to have ties to Russian intelligence. Manafort instructed Rick Gates, his deputy on the campaign and a longtime employee, footnote 839, to provide Kilimnik with updates on the Trump campaign, including internal polling data, although Manafort claims not to recall that specific instruction. Manafort expected Kilimnik to share that information with others in Ukraine and with Deripaska. Gates periodically sent such polling data to Kilimnik during the campaign. Manafort also twice met Kilimnik in the United States during the campaign period and conveyed campaign information. The second meeting took place on August 2, 2016, in New York City. Kilimnik requested the meeting to deliver in person a message from former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, who was then living in Russia. The message was about a peace plan for Ukraine that Manafort has since acknowledged was a backdoor means for Russia to control eastern Ukraine. Several months later, after the presidential election, Kilimnik wrote an email to Manafort expressing the view, which Manafort later said he shared, that the plan's success would require U.S. support to succeed. Quote, "All that is required to start the process is a very minor wink or slight push from Donald Trump," unquote. Footnote 840. The email also stated that if Manafort were designated as the U.S. representative and started the process, Yanukovych would ensure his reception in Russia, quote, "at the very top level," unquote. Manafort communicated with Kilimnik about peace plans for Ukraine on at least four occasions after their first discussion of the topic on August 2nd. December 2016, the Kilimnik email described above, January 2017, February 2017, and again in the spring of 2018. The office reviewed numerous Manafort email and text communications and asked President Trump about the plan in written questions. Footnote 841. The investigation did not uncover evidence of Manafort's passing along information about Ukrainian peace plans to the candidate or anyone else in the campaign or the administration. The office was not, however, able to gain access to all of Manafort's electronic communications. In some instances, messages were sent using encryption applications. And while Manafort denied that he spoke to members of the Trump campaign or the new administration about the peace plan, he lied to the office and the grand jury about the peace plan and his meetings with Kilimnik, and his unreliability on this subject was among the reasons that the district judge found that he breached his cooperation agreement. Footnote 842. The office could not reliably determine Manafort's purpose in sharing internal polling data with Kilimnik during the campaign period. Manafort, redaction, grand jury, did not see a downside to sharing campaign information, and told Gates that his role in the campaign would be, quote, "good for business," unquote, and potentially a way to be made whole for work he previously completed in the Ukraine. As to Deripaska, Manafort claimed that by sharing campaign information with him, Deripaska might see value in their relationship and resolve a, quote, disagreement, unquote, a reference to one or more outstanding lawsuits. Because of questions about Manafort's credibility and our limited ability to gather evidence on what happened to the polling data after it was sent to Kilimnik, the office could not assess what Kilimnik, or others he may have given it to, did with it. The office did not identify evidence of a connection between Manafort's sharing polling data and Russia's interference in the election, which had already been reported by U.S. media outlets at the time of the August 2nd meeting. The investigation did not establish that Manafort otherwise coordinated with the Russian government on its election interference efforts. A. Paul Manafort's ties to Russia and Ukraine. Manafort's Russian contacts during the campaign and transition periods stem from his consulting work for Deripaska from approximately 2005 to 2009, and his separate political consulting work in Ukraine from 2005 to 2015, including through his company DMP International LLC, DMI. Kilimnik worked for Manafort in Kiev during this entire period and continued to communicate with Manafort through at least June 2018. Kilimnik, who speaks and writes Ukrainian and Russian, facilitated many of Manafort's communications with Deripaska and Ukrainian oligarchs. 1. Oleg Deripaska consulting work. In approximately 2005, Manafort began working for Deripaska, a Russian oligarch who has a global empire involving aluminum and power companies and who is closely aligned with Vladimir Putin. Footnote 843. A memorandum describing work that Manafort performed for Deripaska in 2005 regarding the post-Soviet republics referenced the need to brief the Kremlin and the benefits that the work could confer on, quote, the Putin government, unquote. Footnote 844. Gates described the work Manafort did for Deripaska as, quote, political risk insurance, unquote, and explained that Deripaska used Manafort to install friendly political officials in countries where Deripaska had business interests. Footnote 845. Manafort's company earned tens of millions of dollars from its work for Deripaska and was loaned millions of dollars by Deripaska as well. Footnote 846. In 2007, Deripaska invested through another entity in Pericles Emerging Market Partners LP, Pericles, an investment fund created by Manafort and former Manafort business partner Richard Davis. The Pericles Fund was established to pursue investments in Eastern Europe. Footnote 847. Deripaska was the sole investor. Footnote 848. Gates stated in interviews with the office that the venture led to a deterioration of the relationship between Manafort and Deripaska. Footnote 849. In particular, when the fund failed, litigation between Manafort and Deripaska ensued. Gates stated that, by 2009, Manafort's business relationship with Deripaska had, quote, dried up, unquote. Footnote 850. According to Gates, various interactions with Deripaska and his intermediaries over the past few years have involved trying to resolve the legal dispute. Footnote 851. As described below, in 2016, Manafort, Gates, Kilimnik, and others engaged in efforts to revive the Deripaska relationship and resolve the litigation. 2. Political consulting work. Through Deripaska, Manafort was introduced to Renat Akhmedov, a Ukrainian oligarch who hired Manafort as a political consultant. Footnote 852. In 2005, Akhmedov hired Manafort to engage in political work supporting the Party of Regions, footnote 853, a political party in Ukraine that was generally understood to align with Russia. Manafort assisted the Party of Regions in regaining power, and its candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, won the presidency in 2010. Manafort became a close and trusted political advisor to Yanukovych during his time as president of Ukraine. Yanukovych served in that role until 2014, when he fled to Russia amidst popular protests. Footnote 854. 3. Konstantin Kalimnik. Kalimnik is a Russian national who has lived in both Russia and Ukraine and was a longtime Manafort employee. Footnote 855. Kalimnik had direct and close access to Yanukovych and his senior entourage, and he facilitated communications between Manafort and his clients, including Yanukovych and multiple Ukrainian oligarchs. Footnote 856. Kalimnik also maintained a relationship with Deripaska's deputy, Viktor Boyarkin, footnote 857, a Russian national who previously served in the defense attaché office of the Russian embassy to the United States, footnote 858. Manafort told the office that he did not believe Kalimnik was working as a Russian spy, footnote 859. The FBI, however, assesses that Kalimnik has ties to Russian intelligence. Footnote 860. Several pieces of the office's evidence, including witness interviews and emails obtained through court-authorized search warrants, support that assessment. Kalimnik was born on April 27, 1970, in Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, then of the Soviet Union, and attended the Military Institute of the Ministry of Defense from 1987 until 1992. Footnote 861. Sam Patton, a business partner to Kalimnik, footnote 862, stated that Kalimnik told him that he was a translator in the Russian army for 7 years and that he later worked in the Russian armament industry selling arms and military equipment, footnote 863. U.S. government visa records reveal that Kalimnik obtained a visa to travel to the United States with a Russian diplomatic passport in 1997, footnote 864. Kalimnik worked for the International Republican Institute's, IRI, Moscow office, where he did translation work and general office management from 1998 to 2005, footnote 865. While another official recalled the incident differently, footnote 866, one former associate of Kalimnik's at IRI told the FBI that Kalimnik was fired from his post because his links to Russian intelligence were too